So welcome to the Sutta class today. We're discussing Sutta Majjhima Nikaya number 52, Attakanagara Sutta. A curious name. It means the country eighth, or the city eighth. Attaka means eighth. One wonders why there was a city called eighth. Never heard of anywhere else. Appearing only here. The eighth, what? Sounds a very... In Malaysia, we kept on... One time I was driving through the... along the highway south of Ipoh, and there were all these towns, and there'd be like the 10-mile town and the 15-mile town and the 20-mile town and so on. And then I said, what's going on? And my stepfather said, well, actually, during the war, the British... and before the British wanted to make it easy to find out where all the villages were, so they just told them to go and live at the point 5 miles, 10 miles, and so on. So they all had to uproot from their villages that they'd been living in, and then never mind where the water was or where they could get food or where they had to do their farming. They all had to go and live on the posts 5 miles, 10 miles, 15 miles, so it's convenient for the British administrators. So maybe there's something like that. It's the Attakanagara, the eighth. Maybe it's a bureaucratic thing. But particularly curious because the householder is called Dasama, which means tenth. The fellow tenth who's living in the city called eighth. Call me weird, but it sounds a bit odd to me. No explanation from the sutta?
What about the Chinese?
What about the Chinese? The Chinese all have the same names as far as I know. But what they do is they call the sutta by Dasama, so by the name of the layman, rather than by the name of the town that he comes from. And again, that's a little bit curious. Why should sutta be called after the town that the character has come from? It's the only sutta in the Majjhima which is called in that way. So perhaps just a bit random choice of title there. Okay, so this particular discourse has a Pali parallel among the 11s of the Anguttara Nikaya. Okay, so there's one sutta in the Anguttara 11s, which is similar to this one. Obviously, since this has the 11 gates to the deathless, and also two Chinese parallels. One of them are Majjhima Agama 2.1.7, being in the Chinese equivalent of the Pali Majjhima Nikaya, translated by Gautama Sanghadeva, and the other one being in Taisho 92. So that's in an individual sutta. So for those of you who haven't been around when we're talking about the Chinese suttas and so on, just to give just a very general introduction to this, we'll be referring throughout to the Chinese suttas and the Chinese canon. Each of the Nikayas in the Pali has its own counterpart collection in the Chinese canon. Now, those counterpart collections are not by any means identical with the Pali, but they are generally speaking similar, and they're organized along similar lines. So with the Digha Nikaya of long discourses, you have the Dirgha Agama of long discourses in Chinese translation. Dirgha Agama we also have now found a Sanskrit version of, which has been rescued from the sands of Afghanistan but hasn't been published yet. In the Majjhima Nikaya we have the Chinese Majjhima Agama, and Sanyutta Nikaya has Sanyutta Agama, the full Sanyutta Agama plus a couple of partial collections of the Sanyutta material. And the Anguttara Nikaya, we have the Ekottara Agama, and also a small partial Anguttara as well. And in addition to those, we also have a number of what they call individual translations, Muktaka in Sanskrit. And these individual translations are really just the things which have been collected here and there along the way, done by various people, which got incorporated at a certain time into the Chinese canon. Some of them are merely just alternative versions of the same suttas that are already in the major Agama collections. Some of them are suttas that are not found elsewhere in the Agama collections. Some of them are early, some of them late, and so on and so forth. So if you can think about it as if they've got the, say, the Majjhima Nikaya translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi, and then at the end of it they collected you know, a few of, say, Venerable Tanisaro's translations and a few translations from here and there and so on, and then put them as an appendix at the end of the Majjhima Nikaya, something like that. So that's what we find in the Chinese Agamas. And that's our main sources of parallels to the Pali Suttas. There's a few things in Tibetan, a few bits and pieces in Sanskrit, a few things found in the Vinayas, but pretty much that's the main source of alternatives, things by which we can compare the Pali. Now, interestingly enough, this particular one, Aptekanagara, was translated by a fellow called Angsha Gao. And Angsha Gao was a very interesting character who says his translation activities took place between 148 and 170 AD. Okay? So that's very early. Most of the Agamas were translated about 400 to 430 AD. So that's 300 something years later. Oh, hang on, 200 something years later. 250 years later. So Angsha Gao was very much a pioneer translator, and he was one of the first who did large numbers, or fairly large numbers, of early suttas into Chinese. And I think he was, if my memory serves me well, he was a Parthian, so from one of the Central Asian republics. So in many cases, like in this case here, that date we have for Angsha Gao and his sutta is actually the earliest fixed date to attest the existence of a particular text. Okay? Now we infer the existence of the Pali text and so on to a much earlier date, so we assume that they were existed, or we not assume, but we conclude by inference that they existed 500 years earlier. But we don't have any concrete evidence for that. And so in many cases, the earliest concrete evidence we have for the existence of a sutta is found in the Chinese translation dates. And that applies for the Pali discourses and also for the Mahayana discourses as well, where very often, in fact normally, we have much earlier evidence for their existence in Chinese than we do have for their existence in Indian sources. Okay. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Venerable Ananda was living at Belava Gamaka near Vesali. Belava, a little village. Belava, this being, I think, one of the villages that was visited by the Buddha shortly before his parinibbana, near Vesali. Now, on that occasion, the household at Dasama of Aptekanagara had arrived in Pataliputta for some business or other. Then he went to a certain bhikkhu in Kukata's park. It's a kind of unusual way of putting it. Kukuta being chicken. Kukuta Rama being the very famous monastery in Pataliputta, which a couple of hundred years later, in the time of King Ashoka, became very famous, and sometimes the Third Council is regarded as being held there. Kukuta Rama. And after paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and asked him, "Where does the Venerable Ananda live now, Venerable Sir? I wish to see Venerable Ananda." And the monk replied, "The Venerable Ananda is living at Belava Gamaka, the Vesali householder." Then the householder Dasama had completed his business at Pataliputta. He went to the Venerable Ananda at Belava Gamaka, the Vesali. After paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and asked him, "What can we learn from that little introductory section?"
Seems quite odd.
Because?
A few elements. The names.
Mm-hmm.
Then going to find out about where Ananda is, and then going back to Pataliputta, and then doing stuff, and then coming to Ananda.
Mm-hmm.
Because the editor, if it really happened, I'll just edit that part out.
Right, yeah. It's not like it's kind of incidental detail, it doesn't really add to it.
Detail that doesn't really add anything to the story that actually happened.
So it's maybe likely to be historical, yeah?
Possible.
We know at the when the Buddha was passing away that they were starting to build up Pataliputta as the next capital, the fortress to defend against the Vajjayans. And so there probably would have been a lot of building contracts going on there. So not implausible to say that there would have been someone going there.
Vajjayans, aren't they the people that lived in Vesali?
That's right, yeah.
But this is a Vesali village, right?
Yep.
So how could you build a fortress of against the Vajjayans if the Vajjayans already live there?
Because that's near the border. Oh. The fortress was Pataliputta, which is on the Ganges, and over the other side of the river would have been Belavagamaka, on the Vajjayan side.
Oh, I have a question. Why would he be asking specifically for Ananda?
Yeah. Why asking especially for Ananda? Why not asking for the Buddha?
Yes.
Because Ananda is loved by many. Because when he teaches in the fourfold assembly, talks to have suttas about that.
When he speaks to the fourfold assembly, they love to listen to him, and they always say, please, Ananda, please, keep on talking, don't stop now. We want to hear more Dhamma from you. But it is interesting, and one of the things we notice is that it starts out, on one occasion, Venerable Ananda was living at such and such. It doesn't say, on one occasion, the Buddha was living at such and such. Which is very unusual, isn't it? And what might we presume from that?
That the Buddha has already passed away.
We might presume the Buddha's already passed away. And how might we be able to confirm or deny our presumption?
Either check the Chinese or keep reading.
Either that or the Buddha's in another part of the country.
Yeah, he's on holiday or something.
Yeah.
But
does this sutta have any reference to the Buddha as to the
No, it doesn't.
Historicity of the event?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't have anything to that can, you know, tie it down as far as I can see, except right at the end there may be maybe something else also there, but quite right here. Okay, another difference in regard to the Pali versions is that the two Chinese discourses begin by reporting that the Buddha had recently attained Parinibbana. Okay, now that's interesting. It seems to me, and I haven't looked at it in detail, but it seems to me that there's an inordinate number of suttas which were given in this very period and which seem to come from the time either just after the Buddha passed away or just before it. I mean, which kind of makes sense. If the canon was collected shortly after the Buddha passed away, it would kind of make sense that those teachings were fresh in the bhikkhus' memories and they would tend to remember those teachings from that period. But there seem to be quite a lot of suttas which were given maybe just after the Parinibbana, or else in the few years beforehand. And there's some hints, like this little hint here, that doesn't mention the Buddha staying somewhere, it mentions Ananda staying somewhere. But in this case, we can confirm that from the Chinese. Seems to suggest, I mean, if we think about it in terms of what's happening in the Sangha at that time, I mean, obviously suggests that Ananda was regarded as somebody worth going and listening to. The fellow who's doing it is called a gahapati, which we translate as a householder. Usually a gahapati is like a, we don't really have a kind of, he's like they would have thought of a citizen in ancient times. You know, where obviously not everybody was regarded as a citizen of the country. I mean, these days it's more egalitarian, so we're all citizens. But in those days a gahapati would have probably been a landowner. Okay, so he's somebody who would have had a house and fields or something like that. So a person of substance, right? Not just, you know, not just a kind of a wandering tradesman or something like that, generally speaking. Do you need a chair? Or you're happy on the ground? Okay. So, and he's obviously travelling to do business, and he makes some quite big offerings at the end of the sutta. So, you know, probably a merchant, a wealthy merchant or something of that sort.
Question I have. Are there any sutta, I mean, after all, if it was after the Parinibbana,
yeah,
then a Mahakasapa would have been the leader of the Sangha.
Right.
But yet, I don't know of any suttas that are actually preached by Mahakasapa.
Yeah, there are some, but you're right, not certainly not so many.
And yet, yeah. Ananda has a tremendous number of suttas.
Yeah.
So a part of it was, of course, because he was associated very closely with the Buddha.
Right.
But maybe he was actually much more socially inclined, or he was, maybe Mahakasapa was also much more of an ascetic, I guess.
Yeah, I'm sure there's something to that, yeah. And it does, you know, it does specifically say that in certain cases that, you know, Ananda had the teaching duties and so on.
And it would be interesting to know, because if it was after the 3-month period, then Ananda would have been an arhat then.
Yeah, it's not sure. It seems likely it was sometime after the Buddha passed away. From the little note in the Chinese, it says, you know, Achira Parinibbuto. So just passed away, but that's a kind of an idiom as well. It's not, you can't really say. I mean, it could have been a few years later. It could have been immediately afterwards, you know. He was staying in Bellavo, it's just near Kusinara. Yeah, he could have been, after the Buddhist Parinibbana, on his journey down to Rajagaha for doing the first council. Yeah? And there's a few other suttas, also set in the Kukudarama, which also, it seems to me, could well have been in a similar situation. Venerable Ananda, has any one thing, eka dhammo, is there any one thing? Is thing a good translation of Dhamma in this context? Is there any one thing that, has any one thing been proclaimed by the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened, wherein, if a bhikkhu abides diligent, ardent and resolute, his unliberated mind comes to be liberated, his undestroyed defilements come to be destroyed, and he attains the supreme security from bondage that he had not attained before.
What about one teaching?
One teaching?
Central teaching.
Yeah, because it's something which is proclaimed, it's taught, it's akata, one dhamma has been taught.
Truth.
Yeah, one truth. Yeah, one thing. There's a whole section of eka dhammas in Anguttara and Itivuttaka, and why there's one dhamma. But just to, you know, just to notice that, you know, there is a this kind of difference of inflection from the translation where thing doesn't really have any resonance as a word, whereas dhamma obviously does. So, you know, we've sort of lost a certain dimension through the translation there. Could be, yeah. Yeah. One dhamma. Yeah. One dhamma, of course, being used in quite a different way these days to mean that there is only one teaching. All the teachings are one. I think he's saying, I'm a businessman.
Yeah.
I'm in here, Pataliputta. I've got to offload my supply of camels. I'm getting back to my place of Attaka. I want something quick. Yeah? There's one thing that I can remember. But Ananda doesn't quite give him one thing, but anyway.
How would you translate it?
Hard to say. Maybe one principle. One thing, one principle,
quality.
One quality. Mm. Anyway, so it's good, you know, just usually just to notice these things is good. You know, reckon the translators can worry about sorting it out. Okay, is there one thing? There is, householder, indeed one such thing proclaimed by the Blessed One. Ati, there is. Ko Gahapati, there is indeed Gahapati. One thing. And what is that one thing? It's a bit of a frustrating answer. You say, yes, there is one thing, yes, and what is it? And what is it? He says, and he gives all the text in full. He says, here. So this idiom in Pali, here, idha, usually, according to the commentary, meaning here in this sasana, in this dispensation. But it seems more, it's just kind of an idiom, just a meaning. So it means something, almost means something like, take the case of, something like that, or, you know, yeah, hypothetically speaking. Here, householder, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome dhammas, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. He considers this and understands it thus. This first jhana is conditioned and volitionally produced. But whatever is conditioned and volitionally produced is impermanent, subject to cessation. If he is steady in that, he attains the destruction of the defilements. But if he does not attain the ending of the defilements because of that desire for the Dhamma, that delight in the Dhamma, then with the destruction of the five lower fetters, he becomes one due to reappear spontaneously in the pure abodes, and there attain final nibbana without ever returning from that world. This is one thing proclaimed by the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened, wherein if a bhikkhu abides diligent, ardent and resolute, His unliberated mind comes to be liberated, his undestroyed defilements come to be destroyed, and he attains the supreme security from bondage that he had not attained before. Okay, so this particular passage starting out, as so often, with the formula for the first jhana, and all those who've been to the sutta classes for a while would recognize this formula. We recited it many times. And so the answer, you know, this particular teaching on the Eka Dhamma is asked or presented in many ways, many times, and the Buddha gives this whole series of teachings. There is this one thing, because, that I teach, and he'll say, getting rid of pride, if you can get rid of pride, you can get enlightened, and then he'll say, there's one thing, and this one thing is getting rid of ignorance, and so on. So there are many different ways you can answer that thing, one thing. Of course, pointing to the fact that all these different aspects of the mind are all related to each other. Yeah, you can't just get rid of ignorance without also addressing all of these other problems. Yeah, so you might think it's one thing, but actually, in one way, it's one thing, but it's also related to everything else that's going on in your mind. Yeah. Now here, Ananda has gone straight to talk about jhanas, and so straight to quite a, you know, he could have given a kind of a general ethical teaching. He's a layman, you know. He's a layman. He's asking about arahantship, so it's a somewhat ambiguous situation. And normally you might expect, okay, you know, get rid of greed or get rid of attachment or something like that. And that was, oh, okay, I'll do that. But here he's saying, no, get into jhanas, right? So it's quite a challenging teaching to start at that level of very advanced meditative attainments. So, and this gives a good example, very good, one of the best examples in the suttas of a very clear, like, how do you develop vipassana on the basis of jhanas, okay? So get in the jhanas and dwell in the jhanas, okay? Upasampaja viharati, okay? So you've got your first jhana. So iti patisanchikkhati. Then he reflects, okay? So this word patisanchikkhati, one of very many words in Pali that mean to reflect, to consider, to contemplate, something like that. And this word is a desiderative reduplication form from, and the root meaning to look at or to observe or think about, something like that. And then doubled, so the form is doubled up in the root. And then has the prefix pati, meaning having a reflective. No, pari is all around. Pati is a reflective. Okay, so pati is like re in English. So pati is a reflective observing. Sun having kind of coming together kind of meaning. Okay, how would you say in English? Reconsideration or something? Recontemplation something? So what all that means is, you know, when you put all that together, is that the very fact that a word can be constructed like that in a language, okay, tells you that the people who are using the language have quite sophisticated notions of what's going on in the mind, okay. Because in languages build up from concrete things up to more abstract things, okay? So this is a word which is, if you like, doubly or triply abstracted, because it starts out with a root meaning which is already referring to a mental thing. It then doubles that and then adds a couple of prefixes onto it. So it's forming a quite a complex structure to try to encapsulate that kind of reflective nature of consciousness. Okay, that ability of us to actually step back within our own minds and reflect on the experience that's been going on within our own minds. And we still don't have in English better words than these Pali words to describe this, you know. And the Pali vocabulary for this is at least as rich as the English vocabulary and at least as suggestive. So it seems that you know, and that's reflective of the Indian tradition generally that the Buddha inherited or was part of, which was always very concerned with the mind.
Would you call this Lokiya Dhamma or Lokottara Dhamma?
what I call it, Lokiya or Lokuttara Dhamma? Yeah, depends in what sense you're meaning those words. But in the suttas, Lokuttara usually means leading towards Nibbana, basically, conducive towards Nibbana. So in that sense, then yes, it would be Lokuttara. If it's in the more precise Abhidhammic sense of being part of the actual path, then there's nothing to suggest that yet. It's more of the preparation towards that. Okay, so Dampi ko patamang jhanang, this first jhana, abhisankatang abhisanchetayitang. Okay, abhisankatang, and Bhikkhu Bodhi's translated it as conditioned and volitionally produced. And these, again, are very suggestive words. And I wrestled for a while with translating these when I was doing Swift Pair of Messengers. I can't remember what I ended up choosing, but again, they're quite aggregated words. You can see that they both have this abhi prefix to them, and then this san. Abhisan katang, abhisan chetayitang, and this is as a pair of words. They follow the waxing syllables principle, which we haven't met for quite a while. Anyone remember what the waxing syllables principle is? Even it's one of your favourites? Something increases with each syllable.
Sorry, again. I've already done this so many times. So.
There's a stylistic feature in Pali that when you have lists of words, that the tendency is that the words with less syllables go at the front and with more syllables are put at the end of the list of words. Okay, so that's a stylistic feature which kind of adds a kind of it adds like a power and a dignity when you're reciting it, because you start up with a shorter and then it gets this kind of longer statements at the end, sort of building up, kind of Wagnerian kind of crescendo thing. And so that's just a stylistic feature, it's a literary feature, but it's useful in that it's almost certainly a literary feature characteristic of the oral tradition. Okay, so when we see it being kept, it's a sign that it's something which derives from the oral tradition. When it's broken, which it sometimes is, then it's a sign that maybe there's been a disruption in the transmission or something like that. Well, that's not an absolute criterion, but it's just one of the very many stylistic or literary criteria that we use for trying to judge these things. So abhisankatang, so this is from the word sankara, the root ka meaning to do. Okay, so construct, abhisankatang, sankara, then abhi is like it is even intensifying it more. Abhisankatang, abhisanchetayitang, and this one is from the root chi, meaning to think, and here from jetana is intention. And so here sankara and sanchetana have obviously the same meaning. And again, it's fairly common in Pali that when you have lists of things, that the items in the list are actually just synonyms. Obviously, they're not always the case, but often it's the case. So we don't need to go necessarily hunting for different meanings for words in a list, because often it happens that they just have the same meaning and that they're given in the list simply so that if the reciters forget one of them, it doesn't change the meaning of the it's like a redundancy thing, yeah? So you can forget one or make a mistake and it doesn't change the meaning of the sentence. But also here is emphasis, abhisankatang, and each one has a slightly different nuance here. It's basically the same meaning, but the abhisankatang has a meaning of like volitionally constructed. Okay, or an act of will. Okay, and so it's volitionally constructed and produced. Okay, so this jhana has been produced through the acts of the mind, the workings of the mind. And you know, you can see obviously that is the case. You come and you sit down to meditate, and you apply your mind. Yeah, and you don't get into jhana unless you do apply your mind. Yeah, you apply your mind in a certain way, direct the mind in a certain way. You know, you don't pay attention to certain things, you do pay attention to certain other things, and you keep on developing that, and then that conditions the mind in a certain way. And your mind, if it stays with the meditation object, will become more peaceful, become more unified, a sense of joy arises in the mind, and gradually you're able to let go of the sense experience and so on. And eventually, when the mind is ready, then it will go into that experience of jhana. Now, what's important about this is that, of course, when the experience of jhana happens, it feels like it's not conditioned. It feels like it's something which happens that you're kind of drawn into, or it's almost like it feels like the appearance of a higher power. And in religions other than Buddhism, it's usually interpreted that way. So within the Brahmanical religion, then it was interpreted as becoming one with Brahma or something like this. And all of the different theistic traditions have their ways of interpreting that. And so what this is saying is, no, it's not evidence of a higher power. It's not sort of, you know, all of these mystical words we use. It's just the state of mind. And it's a state of mind which is being produced by that meditation process which you've been going on. And further back by that, you can see it's also conditioned by your sila, by your activities. All the things you've done in your life have, in fact, been conditioning this state of mind. And then that's that. Yeah? And so it's not God. But in a sense, of course, it is God, right? It's God in the sense that, according to Buddhism, the Brahmas and the gods are produced by the same sort of consciousness. So in a sense, it's quite right to say it's God. Yeah, but it's not God in the sense of being an eternal, abiding essence, okay, the ground of the universe or these kinds of things. Okay, so this is that process of developing insight on the basis of jhanas. Okay. What is your young pana kinchi abhisankatang abhisanjeta itang tadanichang nirodha dhammanti pajanati? So then one understands, again, this reflective process, whatever is conditioned volitionally produced, that is impermanent. Tadanichang nirodha dhammang, and is subject here, dhamma meaning subject to, or of the nature to cessation. Okay, the nature of cessation. So datta pito asavanan kayam papunati. So standing in that, literally what it means is, standing in that, he attains the ending of the defilement. Okay? So obviously here, it's kind of quite a vivid phrase, but here standing having the meaning of being established in that, with this as your basis, or with this as your perspective, you attain the destruction of the defilements. Pajanati is understands. So it means literally he understands. It means he attains. So they don't have any relation at all. So in this one, pajanati, the root is jhanang, or jnya. Okay? And pa is the prefix. And again, papunati, what's the root of papunati? Yeah, it means to attain. I can't remember exactly what the root is of that at the moment. Now, keep going.
So, Bhante, what is the difference between abhisankatam and abhisanchetayutam?
I don't think there's a concrete difference in meaning. Abhisankatam maybe could be understood in a sense as being slightly a more objective sense. This is just very interpretive, but it could be understood in more of an objective sense, that the abhisankatam is the is what has been constructed, in a sense, whereas the abhisanchetayitang is referring to the attitude of mind that has brought about the construction. Okay? But that's very interpretive. I don't actually think that it's meant to have different meanings here. I think it's meant to have the same meaning. Very often, sankhara is simply glossed by saying chetana. So you simply say, what does sankhara mean? It means chetana. That's the normal explanation for it, say, independent origination, or in the five khandhas, and so on. Okay, so then there would just be the same meaning. So one contemplates the impermanence of them. Okay, so of course then you can see that from the meditative experience itself, that it lasts for a certain period of time, and then it disappears. So this is a matter of perception or understanding the nature of that experience. What it often feels like, and often is interpreted as, if you come from a theistic background, is that, you know, it's almost like there is this eternal abiding self or abiding presence or God or divinity or whatever however you conceive of it, and that there's a period where you come in contact with that. Okay, so the thing itself is permanent, okay, but you come in contact with that, and so then that creates the impression or can lead to the inference that actually that state is permanent, okay, yeah. But it's just the fact that I'm not always with it. So if I was to contemplate more and so on, I'll be able to abide in that forever. And especially after I die, I'll be able to go and live in that state forever. And so that's a very tempting way of thinking about it. Yeah. And so what this is saying is no, that's not the case. It's that realm that you go to is actually that something that's produced within your own mind. It doesn't abide out there in some independent sphere that's eternal. It's something that's a condition which is produced by your state of mind. Sorry?
It's your place.
It's your place, yeah. You construct it, yeah? And then you kind of go out. And because it is Nirodha Dhammang, it doesn't last forever. Okay?
Then again, you could say that you cannot produce it.
Mm.
If it is impermanent, then you could only ever produce it once. And you could never get it again.
Well, you can never produce exactly the same thing again. You can produce similar ones. But that's getting very ontological there.
Yeah.
Can you cross over the same river twice? Do you have to invent a new name for the river every time you cross it over? So that's the idea that the name inheres in the person or the thing. Fortunately, we don't have to do that, so there you go. Yeah?
How would the experience of jhana then be different from the experience of nibbana?
Ah, now that's a good question. How would the experience of jhana then be different from the experience of nibbana?
Because you attain nibbana, but then you don't stay in that state permanently. It's parinibbana.
Yeah. Any suggestions?
Jhana is still has the mind present, so in six senses, there's uh-huh. one sense left, so there's still the mind that's present
yeah.
in the jhanas, but then higher attainments, then there's no mind that ceases too.
Yeah.
Such as Nirodha Samapatti. But if you attain those stages without destroying other causes, so the causes to get to that attainment are different from that which leads to the ending of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
So the ending of suffering is by destroying greed, just by attaining jhana or the infinite of consciousness doesn't necessarily end your greed
yeah.
as such. That only temporarily the five senses disappear for some time, and it's because of the lack of the five senses not being there that you experience that. So it's the experience of them being lacking, that's what you experience.
Yeah.
So when you attain nibbana, it's actually destroying the causes that lead to rebirth.
Yeah.
So, but attaining jhana is not, because that's not destroying the cause.
Yeah. So would you know that? Would you know that immediately?
One may.
According to Jnanatiloka, when you attain jhana, if it's very pure jhana,
yeah.
then the five senses are no longer functioning.
Yeah. Yeah. Would you know, so we understand that in the jhana that the defilements are suppressed, but they're still capable of arising. If one attains nibbana, let's say, just to keep it clear, attains to arahantship, the defilements are completely ended. Is that immediately apparent? Is it? But you might not have. There might not be arisen. Say someone who's got jhanas, maybe don't have any defilements.
Well, it seems to me that a lot of people may attain some state of concentration and they think they're enlightened.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of mistakes.
Yeah.
That are being made all the time. I don't want to say necessarily in Theravada Buddhism, but in all sorts of in other Buddhist sects, and particularly in other so-called teachings of other religions.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, they don't even consider nibbana. They consider the state which you call the unification with the deity.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
as far as they go.
As far as they go. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it is difficult to say. I mean, it would seem to me that there would be a qualitative difference in the experience. It would feel like a different kind of thing. And that the peace of jhana would be felt to be not nearly as peaceful as you thought it was, you know, once you get to the Lukkha attainments. Just as a bit of background for that, there are quite a few interesting passages in the suttas which mention or talk about some kind of attainment which seems to be like a meditative experience of nibbana or arahantship or something like that. And these are described in a tone of wonder. Yeah, there's like how could it be so? Or what could this be like? Yeah, and it's described in different ways. And we won't go into the details here, but it does seem that there is something which enlightened beings can go into a space, into an attainment of the mind which is not an ordinary jhana, not that jhanas are ever ordinary, but not an ordinary jhana, and yet it's not obviously the complete parinibbana. So those kind of states are always hard to do. I mean, I think the crucial thing with what you're mentioning there and the problem of overestimation, obviously being a kind of conceit, is simply, I mean, the best piece of advice was given by Venerable Jnana Vimala in Sri Lanka, and he when Ajahn Brahm visited him years ago, one of the things he said was never announce your attainments, not even to yourself. So I think that's a good thing to do. I mean, if you want to ask about your attainments of a teacher, then that's different. So, you know, because you want to learn about it. But in terms of just going around talking about I've got this, I've got that, it's very... And you know, even if you think you've got something in your own mind, then Ajahn... Yeah, well, they can do, yeah. And you can become nuts as well. Ajahn Chah said that, you know, if you think you've become a stream enterer, then that's uncertain. And if you think you've become an arahant, then that's like really uncertain. Yeah. So that's always a very good thing to do. As long as you're keeping investigating, then you're all right. As if you give up and you think you've got it and therefore you don't have to practice anymore, then you're in trouble. Okay, but that's the basic principle.
And again, what about, I mean, somebody who's not a Buddhist, they don't have the terminology, and maybe they get enlightened. Yeah, but then the only way they can describe it is with the language that they know, and might say, well, become God or whatever.
Yeah.
So you still don't know what they're talking about.
Very, very difficult, yeah. Very, very hard to know these things. Yeah, I mean, there's the kind of the mystical language. There's a certain degree where you can say that there are important things in common with mystical experiences in all different traditions. But there's also an irreducible element where the way that it's described is totally conditioned and within the context of whatever linguistic environment that you're in. You use the words that you have. To compare from one to the other in that respect is very difficult. And I think the only way you're able to do, if you want to be serious about that, you know, you really just have to go and practice in that tradition, realize what they're talking about. You know, you go to the teacher and say, is this what you were talking about? Like the Buddha did with his first teachers, you know? He went there, he did the thing, is this what you're talking about? They said, yep. He said, that's rubbish, I'm out of here. Right? And it wasn't based on just speculating about it, yeah. It was based on actually doing it and actually realizing it. And once you've done that, then you've got a basis to compare. Otherwise, we have to be very cautious about these things. Okay, so just another little...
Conditionally reproduced. Is this a thought process in the mind, or is this just an insight?
The insight happens as an insight. The way it's expressed and phrased here, as always, I think kind of over-literalizes it a little bit. I mean, again, it's just the idioms that are available in Pali for using that. But I think that really what happens is that, you know, we absorb the teachings and, you know, through things like what we're doing now and our contemplations, our reading and so on, we absorb them. And the more and more we absorb them, then it becomes just a natural thing so that, you know, in a sense, just the idea occurs to you. Or that perspective occurs to you of impermanence, and then the mind sort of follows into that. And at that stage, after emerging from jhana, the mind's so pure that it doesn't really need too much in terms of a program to do. Just that little hint, and then it can follow along, and it will know what to do. I mean, this is I struggled with these things for many years, but the important thing that I realized with those things is that those stories are stories, and they're never presented as being this is the way of practice that you need to do. And so that's quite two different kinds of things. One's an illustration, which is meant to inspire us, And then another thing is a teaching saying, well, this is how you should practice. And there's no teaching saying, because pour water over your feet until you get enlightened or anything like that, okay? But there are plenty saying, go and do jhanas and get and investigate it.
Would you call that vipassana?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. This is the paradigm of what vipassana is, yeah. Is contemplating contemplating impermanence, conditionality. Mm-hmm. That's precisely vipassana, yeah.
Because the Buddha says monks develop concentration.
Yep.
He who has concentration sees impermanence.
Yep, yep.
So what that means is that if by developing concentration, that person is able to reflect on the state of concentration and see that that is also impermanent.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Now the other thing which is interesting about this, and it's a bit of a if we look at Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. If he does not attain the destruction of the defilements because of that desire for the Dhamma, that delight in the Dhamma, then with the destruction of the five lower fetters, he becomes an anagami. Okay? Now, this is a bit ambiguous, actually. Teneva dhammaragena taya dhammanandiya. Due to that, or because of that, it's an instrumental case. Dhammaraga, the love for Dhamma, the delight in Dhamma, then one's born in the pure abode. So what's it saying here? Is it saying that if you weren't attached to Dhamma, you'd become an arahant? But because you've still got that attachment to Dhamma, then you have to get the consolation prize of becoming a anagami? Or is it saying that even those who don't become arahants, if they have the love of Dhamma, then they can become anagamis? Okay, so in other words, is the love of Dhamma here being a positive or presented in a positive or negative light? The commentary interprets it in the former way as a negative light. It's saying that the attachment to the Dhamma prevents your full enlightenment, and you get to go to the pure abode and stay there for a few hundred eons enjoying bliss and light and so on. I mean, it's all right, it's a consolation prize. And that's that very, very subtle level of attachment that's not letting you go completely. The Chinese versions are all similar. One of the Chinese versions, the Madhyama Agama version, talks about gaining calmness or gaining peace in relation to Dhamma. Okay? So that seems to suggest the option that it's a positive thing, that one's peaceful regarding Dhamma rather than being attached to Dhamma. And the individual translation in Chinese relates craving for the Dhamma to developing the Dhamma and having reverence or respect for it. Okay, and according to Venerable Analia, these presentations seem to support the alternative explanation according to which lust for the Dhamma, Dhamma Raga, is what leads to non-return rather than what's preventing arahantship. Could be the Dhamma here could be the attachment to the meditation experience, yeah, or Dhamma could mean Dhamma in general, or it could be something like the qualification of Dhamma. Sometimes Dhamma means like right, okay, yeah. So somebody who's a Dhammika Raja is a righteous king, yeah. So in that case, it would be a positive sense. It would mean because of that, you have that pure delight in the teachings or in the Dhamma, and then you become an anagami.
Isn't that the same paragraph where he's talking about the first jhana, though?
Yep.
So wouldn't it follow that when he says Dhamma Ragena,
Dhamma
that he might be referring to the first jhana?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly... I mean, it's certainly a reasonable interpretation. I mean, it is separated by a number of lines. Dhammaragena is down here, and the first jhana is up there, and he's got all this vipassana contemplation in between. So I don't think that interpretation is required. It's certainly a reasonable one. I don't think it's necessary.
The other thing about what you mentioned before is because he first mentions nirvana. Arhantship there?
He says the Asavakaya ending of defilements.
Right.
Is similar.
So that was always the goal that the Buddha was pointing to.
Right.
So it would seem if the other thing about the other remark about being born in the uh, uh, in a uh,
In the pure abodes?
In the pure abodes, a fine material realm came after that. Maybe he's comparing the two.
Yeah, yeah.
Which would mean that it would be a step down from from arhatship.
Yeah.
I mean, just by the context, basically.
Yeah. Consolation prize.
Isn't this used in other contexts as well?
Dhammaraga. It is, according to Analia, not only Dhammaraga, but even the term craving, tanha, occurs in other Pali discourses with positive connotations. And he quotes here for the Anguttara Nikaya. It says, based on craving, craving can be overcome. Based on tanha, tanha can be overcome. This occurrence shows that in the discourse, the implications of some terms are not as uniform as in later Pali texts. By the time of the Abhidhamma and the commentaries, the implications of key terminology were so clearly delineated and fixed that terms such as lust and craving were used only with a negative meaning. This may well be, I don't know, I'm not 100% convinced that that's correct, but this is Virumbala Nalio's comment on it. This may well be why the commentaries interpreted the present occurrence of the expression lust in a negative way, although the Chinese parallels to the present discourse indicate that this may not be the only possible way of understanding the implications of the expression lust for Dhamma. Yeah, I think he's quite giving quite a balanced presentation there. I think probably either version could be read out of the text, and it's more kind of a balance of probabilities, which one you think is more plausible. Yes, you may, Eva.
The way Bhikkhu Bodhi has it, desire for the Dhamma, delight in the Dhamma, couldn't possibly be wrong.
Couldn't possibly be wrong. Okay, well, you keep on developing your delight in the Dhamma. And there's all kinds of Dhammas, yeah.
There's all kinds of Dhammas.
Well, we know what this Dhamma is. It's got a capital D.
Right. Yeah, that's probably another. It's a bit. So we've got Dhamma. Remember, at the beginning we have Dhamma as thing, and then in the jhana formulas, Dhamma is translated as state, and now we have Dhamma as capital D Dhamma. And I think in all of those cases we could question whether that's the best way of rendering it, but not very difficult to get this. I should actually backtrack a little bit. When we're talking about the insight stage here, and here in the Pali it says you see that they're conditioned and constructed, and because they're conditioned and constructed you can see that they're impermanent and subject to cessation. Okay, now the Chinese versions are slightly different. The Madhyama Agama version simply speaks of contemplating dhammas as dhammas. Okay, so this is obviously a phrase that's familiar from the Satipatthana Sutta. And it's the same phrase used in the Madhyama Agama version of the Satipatthana Sutta. Judging from this other occurrence, the expression to contemplate dhammas as dhammas in the present context could refer to developing mindfulness and insight with regard to concentration experiences listed. So that, I think, is certainly in accord with what dhammas as dhammas means in the Satipatthana Sutta, where it occurs after Vedana Anupassana and Chitta Anupassana, which include samadhi experiences. And so contemplating dhammas as dhammas, I think, means contemplating the conditionality and impermanence of those experiences. At least part of the meaning. That could be interpreted in a broader sense as well. The individual translation speaks of the characteristics of the dhammas and instructs to contemplate motion and stopping. Okay? The last two characters, which going, stopping, sankhara, cessation, yeah? Sometimes mean behavior or whereabouts. But
that's the same, behavior or whereabouts.
It's probably. Remembering that this is a very early translation, the individual translation, Angshikar, so very archaic Chinese, and also one of the first people to wrestle with trying to get this Indian vocabulary into Chinese. So he's a real pioneer. How would you translate this? Dhamma. Dhamma appearance. Okay. So, the ending of activities, maybe. I think in that case, you know, we seem to have a slight variation in the wording of the Chinese versions, but no difference really in the meaning there. We're up to paragraph number 5. Again, Punacaparang, so this idiom in Pali, Punacaparang, translated as again. Householder, with the stilling of vitaka and vichara, a bhikkhu enters and abides in the second jhana. So the text gives the full second jhana formula, with internal confidence and clarity and one-pointedness of mind. It has the without vitaka and vichara, and has the rapture and bliss born of concentration. Okay, and then reflects in exactly the same way. It can reflect in exactly the same way, and that too can lead to either of those two options: the ending of defilements, arahantship, or to non-return. Interestingly enough, given that the description in the Chinese versions of insight is identical with the Satipatthana Sutta, it's interesting that the two outcomes are also identical with the Satipatthana Sutta. It says arahantship or non-return. Okay, so third jhana, fourth jhana, the same, and then to the four Brahma Viharas. Okay, again, a bhikkhu abides pervading one quarter. So this is a very lovely chant that we used to do at Watnana Chant. It'd be a good one maybe we could do here as a chant. Metta sahagate na cetasa ekam disang paritva viharati tatha dutiyam tatha tatiyam tatha chatuttam idhiyuddhama dhotiriyam. It's got a nice kind of roll to it. So this is the formula for the Brahma Viharas, developing a metta, pervading all around the world with that. This particular phrase here, sabba tathaya, and sabba all, atta oneself, ta meaning abstract, is an abstractive ending. So it's usually interpreted as meaning to all as to oneself. Okay? And so a little bit similar to the Brahmanical tatvangasi thing, you are that, okay? The whole universe as to oneself. But here interpreted not as a state of final liberation, but as a state of concentration of mind. But there is a alternative reading we have down here, sabba tathaya, here not oneself, but as atta here, probably meaning, atta can mean either goal, right, as in the goal of practice, but here perhaps meaning benefit, or with a feeling or with a thought of benefit for all. That's a possible interpretation, but the most likely interpretation, because it's all talking about spreading it all over the world, so I think to me to make sense to each as to oneself is the how I render that. Okay, and also, you know, notice with this description how big the whole thing is, you know? It's everywhere, it's all over the world. Tiriang sabadi, chetisa, vipulena. Mind which is vast. Yeah? Mahagatena, maha is great. Gata means into a state of greatness. Apamarnena, immeasurable. Yeah? And so when we talk about concentration, sometimes we think concentration means sort of pounding in like one point, yeah? In making the mind very narrow and constricted. But that's not what it means at all, yeah? And so this is, that mind is completely vast, let go of all limits. All over the universe, just like the Beatles, you know. But perhaps kind of doing it rather than singing about it. Yeah. And again, with this kind of experience, one can enter into insight in exactly the same way. Now, there's a rather curious thing that when we find these different attainments presented in the suttas, that there's no, or it's difficult to find, if we say what's the relationship between the four jhanas and the four Brahma Viharas, okay? We have, so this is the metta, and then it continues on with karuna, compassion, mudita, appreciation, joy, and upekkha, equanimity, each described in the same way. Now, the suttas usually present things as we have them here, where you just have the four jhanas described, and then you have the four Brahma Viharas described, and it doesn't tell you what the relationship between those two things is, okay? It just sort of presents them one after the other, and so you sort of have to go, well, how are these connected? Now, what the Abhidhamma says is that something like the four jhanas are the basic description. We think of the four jhanas as the description, if you like, of the subjective attitudes or mental qualities that are present. And those particular mental qualities that are present can be developed using a number of different meditation objects. Okay? And so also the kasinas, or doing the breath, and doing Brahma Viharas and so on, all of these can be used to develop these states of mind called the four jhanas. And so according to the commentarial explanation, which to me seems reasonable in this, this explanation actually starts with the Dhammasangani, the first book of the Abhidhamma, where it starts to take these things and combine them, put them together, put them in relationship. Okay? And so it seems to me quite reasonable. So the general explanation in the commentaries is that because metta, loving kindness, compassion, and mudita, appreciative joy, they all have sukha involved with them. Okay? So they all have a feeling of bliss. So they can be used for developing the first three jhanas, and then the fourth jhana correlates with, of course, upekkha as the fourth of the four Brahma Viharas. Okay? So this the standard explanation. There are one or two places in the suttas where it actually does relate the things. For example, there's one sutta in the Digha Nikaya where it talks about the Buddha in one of his past lives as a king, and he renounces and he says, "Oh, I've heard that if you develop the Karuna jhana, you can be reborn in the Brahma realm," so the compassion jhana. Okay, so you're actually combining those two things in a way which is not normal in the suttas, but it seems to be suggestive of that same kind of idea.
Yeah? One thing that's interesting is that I think you can, from what I understood at least at Pawat, was that you could cultivate metta, karuna, and mudita in the first jhana, the second jhana, and the third jhana.
Right.
But that upekkha could only be cultivated in the fourth jhana.
Right. Yeah, because it doesn't have the happiness associated with it. Yeah.
So it seems to be a little bit more, I don't want to say higher, but...
It's a slightly more mature kind of attitude. But it's interesting that maturity of upekkha comes after developing the metta and compassion and so on, yeah?
Yes.
And so if you don't have those things first, then it's easy for upekkha, for equanimity, to become like indifference. You don't care. But if you've got, you know, a lot of metta and compassion, and then you can also have the equanimity. And I think that's really important. That's where you see someone like the Dalai Lama is a very good example, you know, because he's obviously got a lot of metta and compassion, but he's also, you know, I think he struggles with it, but just with just having the equanimity about the whole politics of what's going on, but you know, he manages to embody that, I think, quite nicely. Yeah. It's very difficult for him, and you know, obviously the whole Thai forest tradition is built up on the basis of attaining jhanas on the Buddha Anusati. So I think the problem there is that the Visuddhimagga explains Buddha Anusati in a discursive way. So yes, if you're doing it in that way, which is a good meditation, but you know, thinking about the qualities of the Buddha, then you're never going to get to jhana like that. But by focusing on using Buddha as a meditation word or an image of the Buddha, then I think you can get into jhanas. But the way it's described in the suttas, I think it's so clear, you know, that it is talking about jhana. It's described in very similar ways that the Brahma Viharas are described, if not even more exalted in some respects. It says, you know, there's no greed, hatred and delusion there from doing Buddha Anusati. So... Just because of that emotional reason that they're connected with happiness. Yeah. I mean, whether you have to consciously develop upekkha as a consciously different thing is a different matter. But it would be a matter that feeling would drop away. But maybe it would happen as a natural maturing of the emotion.
Isn't the case that those are just an object which you use, but the attainment itself is something quite different from the object you use to attain that?
Not quite. It's you can distinguish in theory, but the attainment still reflects the qualities of the object that you've used to attain it.
So why does the breath then can develop into four, whereas the other three can't?
you mean the three Brahmaviharas can't, because the breath in and of itself doesn't have any like inherent emotional qualities, but it only has the emotional qualities that we bring to it. Yeah. The nature of the breath, when you go very deeply into it, breath starts out as air. When you go into it, it seems more like you see the pleasant and the blissful aspect of it. But when you go even further into it, you know, you just see the light and the energy aspect of it. And so the breath and that subtle level of meditation is actually just like an energy. And that energy is just like a life force. It doesn't have any particular emotional connotation.
What about the Buddha talking about Bhikkhus developed better meditation, he had the benefits, and the benefits was that he was Brahma for such a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But if one is Brahma,
the
Brahma, then you obviously need to go beyond third jhana to be able to get to that. So how can you develop...
What do you mean, the Brahma?
Well, if you're Brahma... Right?
Mahabrahma?
Yeah, if you're Mahabrahma.
Mahabrahma is usually interpreted as being in the first jhana realm. Because the Brahmas that actually, you know, come down to see the Buddha and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I talked to Ajahn Brahm about this once. I said, you know, why is it the ones in the first jhana? Because his thought was that from the second jhana onwards, the mind is really stuck. It's like really solid. And that they're basically out of it. They just kind of sit up there most of the time. Kind of out of it. Whereas in the first jhana, because it's closer to the conditioned realm, or the conditioned realm, but the sensory realm, a bit more wobble in it, so you can kind of leave the state of actual jhana and then come down and participate. Yeah. You can't develop metta or something deeply if you're, you know, really partisan. You know, that's why you sort of gradually develop for different people so that you can overcome your. It's not attachment anymore. Yeah.
So the first one is the loving kindness, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then the compassion.
Yeah, compassion.
And then the sympathetic joy.
Yep. Anybody go? Rebecca. Okay, so then from there moves on to the formless attainments. Okay, so again, the relationship between the formless attainments and the jhanas is, I think, clear enough in the suttas. They're called the anupubba nirodha, the gradual cessations, or anupubba vihara, sort of a gradual idea of the mind gradually settling down through the ending of more and more subtle mental factors or aspects of the mind keep on ending and settling down, and then one goes into the formless jhanas. Sabbaso rupa sanyanam samatikamma. So rupa here, and the rupa sanya being the perception of the meditation nimitta. Okay, so usually in a form jhana you'll have an experience of light, vision of bliss or something like that, and so that disappears. Okay. Patiga sanyanam attangama. Patiga is a term here. It's a very technical term in Buddhist psychology, which means it's like a kind of resistance or limitation, and it's a particular kind of perception or impact on the mind which is caused by some kind of limit. And here the limit again is the presence of the meditation object. Okay, so even the light and the bliss of the jhana experience is itself a kind of limit. It's constricting the way that you perceive the world in a very 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 subtle way. Okay, so that patiga sanya is associated with the rupa khanda, the form aggregate, and when the form aggregate is completely disappearing, you don't have the patiga sanya. So it's again, even though the mind's already been measureless, but now even that measurelessness is refining itself away. Okay. Nanatta sanyanang amanasikara, not paying attention to perceptions of diversity. And so here again emphasizing the unity of the whole experience. And you know, you don't have mind and body anymore, the body's completely dropped away. Even the subtlest echoes of the physical realm have dropped away. And so there's an even more intense feeling of unity. Ananto akaso, infinite is space. Okay? Ananto akaso. So it, again, this is explained in the commentaries, and I quite like this explanation, that the nimitta that one's developed previously in fourth jhana one's developed this nimitta which goes infinitely, so wherever you look you can see this bright light, and then that's removed, the light is removed, right? And then you've still got the infinity, but it's the infinite space, it's what was there before when the light is taken away, quite a nice way of thinking about it. So then one reflects on that, this too is conditioned, and so on. And the completely overcoming the base infinite space, thinking consciousness is infinite. And so again, this is explained as that, you know, the mind is aware of this infinite space, and now one's reflecting back on the mind that is aware of it. So instead of being aware of the space, you're aware of the consciousness which is holding or which is aware of the infinite space. And even that, still, it's not good enough to get rid of it. It's rubbish. Then, completely getting rid of that, then what if we were even to get rid of this consciousness, what would we be aware of then? We're not aware of the infinite space, we're not aware of infinite consciousness, we're just aware of nothingness. So this is starting to get really out there, right? How do you describe these things? How do you think about them? Now, normally, when these things are talked about, it goes on to the what's it been down there? Oh, let's wreck that one. Hello, microphone. Welcome back. Okay. Normally, we have the four formless attainments. Basically, infinite space, infinite consciousness, nothingness, and neither perception nor non-perception. And in this case, we only have three, explained by the Pali commentary as that the fourth attainment, neither perception nor non-perception, is so incredibly subtle that you can't even really do any insight on the basis of it, because it's neither this nor that, and you're gonna. So you can't. It's just too much, and so it seems to be in the Pali. There's a few contexts where it's suggested. It seems that this third formless attainment, the base of nothingness, and also the fourth jhana. These seem to be the two prime attainments for developing insight. I mean, obviously, this sutta is showing us we can develop vipassana on all of those attainments, but here it seems that base of infinite space is the base of nothingness is particularly good. However, the Chinese versions, both of the Chinese versions, do include the fourth formless attainment. Okay, and so if we were to think about why that difference would arise, I think the most obvious explanation for that you have is the lekito difficultor. Is that right? There's Mel when you need her. The principle that the more difficult reading is more probable, okay? And so in this case, because the four formless attainments is a very standard set, you can imagine it would be very easy for the reciters, if they've got a sutta with only three of them, that they would naturally just continue to recite the fourth one by habit, okay? So it seems to me more likely that it would that in this case, that the Chinese version is less reliable, the Pali version probably more reliable, and that the fourth one was added on by mistake later, but that's only a presumption, it's not a proof. Okay. In any case, of course, we know the sutta is included in the Anguttara 11s, and so the fixing of the number as 11 attainments must have happened before it was included in the Anguttara 11s. Right. So, when? Now, up to paragraph 15. When Venerable Ananda had spoken, the householder Dasama of Attakanagara said to him, "Venerable Ananda, just as if a man seeking one entrance to a hidden treasure, ekan nidhi mukhan." Okay, so there's the store, treasure. came all at once upon 11 entrances to a hidden treasure. Okay? Sakideva, all at once. Ekadasa, 11 entrances to a hidden treasure. So too, while I was seeking one door to the deathless, I have come all at once to hear of 11 doors to the deathless. Just as if a man had a house with 11 doors, and when that house caught on fire, he could flee to safety by any one of those 11 doors, so too I can flee to safety by any one of those 11 doors to the deathless. So, the assembly of the house on fire and escaping from the house on fire, of course, being a classic part of the Lotus Sutra later on, and being one of the most famous similes in all of Buddhism, developed in quite some detail in the Lotus Sutra. It's one of the, seems to be, as often with the Mahayana Sutras, you can see that the ideas and similes used in them were derived from the early suttas, and then they take them off in their own direction, develop them in ways sometimes justifiable in terms of the early suttas, sometimes maybe less justifiable. Now, Venerable Sir, these sectarians will even seek a teacher's fee for their teacher. Why shouldn't I make an offering to the Venerable Ananda? Okay, so these Anyatitya, people who belong to other religions, will even seek Acharyasa, Acharya Dhanang, a payment for their teacher. So, yes, well, something that's definitely worth bearing in mind, that obviously the principle was in Buddhism that we do not seek a fee for the teacher, and something which I think is a very good principle to uphold. Why do I not make an offering to the Venerable Ananda? And so here the idea of offering is not something Ananda has hinted at or he's made any suggestion at, and we know that there are hundreds of teachings where the Buddha or Ananda or Sariputta or whatever give teachings, and there's no mention or any expectation of getting an offering or anything on part of it. However, in this case, the fellow, who quite possibly is a wealthy merchant, spontaneously had the inspiration, why don't I make an offering? And so this is really the way things should be done in Buddhism. And then the householder Dasama of Aptaka Nagara assembled the Sangha of bhikkhus from Pataliputta and Vesali. Pataliputta and Vesali, I don't think it implies all of the bhikkhus from Pataliputta and Vesali, but probably just some monks from Pataliputta and Vesali. And with his own hands he served and satisfied them with various kinds of good food. So this idiom in the Pali, Parinitena is refined, Karaniena, Bhojaniena, we have Karaniena, and Bhojaniena literally meaning something like hard food and soft food. And so it means stuff like that, like both the staples, rice and bread and so on, and also the various kind of sauces and curries and fruits and condiments and whatever. He presented a pair of cloths to each bhikkhu. So, Pacheka Dusa Yuga. So this idea of the Dusa Yuga is mentioned quite a few times, the pair of cloths being the lower and upper robe. Okay, so this being a standard set of robes for each bhikkhu, and individually presented a pair of cloths. And he had a dwelling worth 500 built for the Venerable Ananda. Panchasatang Viharang. So here Viharang, Vihara, these days usually meaning a monastery, but the original meaning of Vihara meaning a dwelling, and in this case certainly would mean a dwelling, like a kuti basically, built for Venerable Ananda. Obviously you wouldn't build a monastery for Venerable Ananda, but you may well build a kuti in the monastery. And he said he was at either doesn't say whether that's in Pataliputta or in Vesali. For 500, if only we could build our kutis for 500 these days. But yeah, looks like it's interesting just thinking about that. But it looks like it's most likely that would be in would have been in Vesali, doesn't it? Because in Belava Gamaka, where Ananda actually was. Anyway, doesn't quite say. And just one last point: the Chinese versions say that the Ananda made dedicated the building to the Sangha of the Four Quarters. So, according to the Chinese versions, he didn't keep it for his own personal use. Peter.
I just want to ask you what the word for the Pali word for death was called.
Amata. Yeah, Amata Dwara. So here we have Amata Dwara. Is the door to the deathless. The door is dwara, and dwara meaning door in almost every Indo-European language. This is a...
What do you mean by
deathless? Well, it can be interpreted in two ways. It can either be interpreted to mean that you go to a state of eternal life. Okay? So in some contexts, it means that. Exactly. And that's how it would have been interpreted, say, by the Hindus and so on in the Buddha's day. But in the Buddhist context, the Buddha often like to use negative words because you don't get caught up in them so much. You've said what something isn't, but you haven't quite said what it is. Yeah, so it leaves you a bit more wiggle room. Yeah. And so in Buddhism, really what undeathless means is, because the Buddha always said that if you get born, then you're going to get age and get sick and die. Yeah? And so it's that realm, where there is no death. There is no birth, there's no aging, there's no death. Yeah. No, not really. In Buddhism, the spirit realm is still birth, aging and death. Yeah, according to Buddhism. So we don't...
That's the spirit realm would be death, basically. Life is life.
Yeah.
Death is death.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, it's undead. Right? So the important thing... No, it's not. It's precisely where you're not reincarnated. Because if you're reincarnated, that's birth. And if you get born, you're going to get aging. You're going to get old and die. That's one way of looking at it. Yeah, yeah. It's neither one thing nor the other. Yeah, and that's why mind starts to slip off it. Yeah, which is not a bad thing, because as soon as you start thinking it's this, then you get kind of stuck there.
So you put
yourself in a rut. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Nirvana. Yeah. Amitabha Buddha's pure land.
Amitabha. Yeah, something like that.
We can see where it came from.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Except Amitai is a different word.
Yeah.
Although it's possibly related to, because the word Amitai is measure, and the death is like the measure of a life. Yeah. So Amita and Amata, similar meaning, but Mata is the same as the English word mortal. So literally is immortal. Time to reflect back on your doings. Yeah, not really. That happens if you die. See, this in Buddhism, the idea of the deathless, it's not something that happens to everyone. All right. Normally, if for most people, according to the Buddhist cosmology, not most people, right, you die, then you get hauled up before the god of death. They're called Yama, and that's exactly what you're talking about there. Then God, the Yama god, says, "Well, did you? You know, what have you been doing with your life? You know." What did you do? Did you do good? Did you do bad? How did you treat people? Were you kind? Yeah. Yama doesn't condemn. He doesn't punish. He just asks questions. Right? So it's up to you to reflect, what have I been doing with my life? Yeah.
Was it worthy?
Sorry?
Was it worthy?
Was it worthy? Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Your journey.
Yeah. So this is what happens to us normally. But that's not what the Buddha's referring to as the deathless here. The deathless is what happens when all of that comes to an end. So there's no spirit, there's no rebirth, there's no reincarnation, there's none of that stuff. It's all come to an end.
The universe turns into a vacuum.
Something like that, yeah.
Enlightenment. Question.
Yeah.
You mentioned 11 doors to the deathless.
Yeah.
But if you take the four jhanas, the four Brahma Viharas, and the four formless meditations.
And it only mentions the three.
Here.
Yeah, here it only mentions three, maybe while you were out of the room, but yeah. Yeah, the last one, Neva Sanya Na Sanya, is not mentioned.
Oh.
And the commentarial explanation is because it's too subtle for developing insight. Yeah. So, but I think when you just came back, we were just discussing that, saying that the Chinese versions do have that.
They do have it.
Yeah, but the Pali versions don't. Yeah. So, 11 doors to the deathless. Yes, Eva! Congratulations!
Avatadvaranam. You said it in most languages, that's the word for door.
Door. Dwara is door. Yeah. Door. What is it in Polish? Door in Polish?
Polish is dvi.
See?
Very similar.
Dvi. Yeah, very similar. And what is it in German?
Dora is in
Sinhalese. Dora in Sinhalese. Anybody, any other contributions? Italian? French?
Porta.
Porta. That's portal. That would be a different... that would be a different route, but there may be... Is there another word for door? It might mean something else. Sometimes it means something else. Portal. Okay. right. And mortal also. Amata. So there's all these So the Amata is also, in the Hindu mythology, the Amata is the ambrosia of the deathless. So the ambrosia is actually from the same root. It's the divine nectar. You drink it and you live forever. Probably the magic mushrooms. Sorry.
The sentence about the delight and in Dhamma and continue with the destruction of the five.
Yeah, and defilements, yeah.
Does that mean when one practice whatever, the one Dhamma, and he become delight in that practice,
uh-huh.
he continue until the five factors been destroyed?
Which five factors are you referring to?
The five, I don't know, which the five that is here?
Oh, here, Panchanang Aramba again, okay, yeah. Okay, yeah, the five. I should have explained that, the five near fetters, or fetters pertaining to the near shore, yeah? So, you know, the 10 fetters, 10 sanyojanas, so the first five are overcome by the anagami, yeah? Which is, what? Who wants to give me the list?
Sense, desire, anger, sloth and torpor, restlessness and...
Well, those are the five hindrances.
There's five hindrances.
yeah,
well,
dodge
it up, she'll be right. Bit of no more gaps, she'll be right.
Personality view. Attachment to rites and rituals.
Yeah.
Skeptical doubt.
Yeah.
Sensual desire.
Yeah.
And anger.
Anger.
Those are the first five.
That's it.
Those five will keep you hooked on, attached to the sensual realm.
No,
because
you've already overcome sensual desire, but they'll keep you attached to the Brahma realm. Yeah, because you just said one of them is sensual desire you've already got rid of, so the anagami has got rid of all those five.
Right.
So they get reborn in a kind of a special camping ground.
Right.
For the conceit of self.
Yeah, so then there's only the very subtle ones left. And what are the subtle ones?
Attachment to the fine material realm.
Mm-hmm. Rupa raga.
Attachment.
So this is the same word raga that we have here. So this may be something that actually is interesting, because that may be connect with we understanding whether this is good or bad, dhamma raga. But rupa raga, attachment to the Brahma realms basically.
Is
one of the attachments which the anagami still has. So that's maybe relevant there. Rupa raga, arupa raga.
Attachment to the immaterial realm.
Yep.
Restlessness.
Yep. So what does restlessness mean there? The anagami is like this. Can't stand still. Give me some more coffee.
Suppose not having attained deathless.
Not having attained arahantship. Yeah.
Knowing what's left to be done.
Yeah.
Not being able to do it.
Yeah.
Sometimes I wonder if people who scratch their head or people like that or just
various habits that we have, you know.
Uh-huh.
If that is that, would that be restlessness?
I think what it means is what Jug was talking about is like a feeling of not quite being there yet,
yeah.
And so the mind is just pushing a little bit. It's just a very subtle push. There's a couple of contexts that suggest, and only suggest, that in a sense it counterparts rupa raga, arupa raga, being more or less attachment to jhanas or samatha experiences, mm-hmm. and uddhaccha being probably maybe attachment to vipassana, in the sense that you're just pushing too hard to investigate and see everything. This came up in the biography of Ajahn Mun, that, you know, first of all he was Ajahn Mahabua. That he was, first of all, was just doing jhanas and just doing jhana, jhana, jhana all day. And then Ajahn Mun said to him, "What are you doing, Bua? You're sitting there like a tree stump all day. Get out there and investigate. You've got to see impermanence. You've got to see conditionality. Watch that body disappearing and breaking up." So he went and then he just did that. And so then he just did that until he made himself like really sick and was just almost killing himself because he was just this incredible effort that he's putting through. And then Ajahn Mun said, "What are you doing, Bua? You're just sitting there thinking all day about stuff. You've got to make your mind peaceful, you know." And so it was about finding that balance.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's to me that seems the most reasonable explanation of what that uddhaccha is. It's just it doesn't have to be in a very coarse form, but just pushing, just a little bit pushing too much.
It comes up with our post-parinibbana with Ananda's attempt at the first, to get into the first council.
Exactly, yeah.
Striving.
It doesn't get it.
And then, rest a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's probably it. Yeah. So that's those three: rupa raga, arupa raga, uddhaccha,
conceit,
mana, conceit, yeah, and ignorance, avijja. Okay. So these are the five further fetters. So these are the five ones. First five has got rid of. The anagami has got rid of.
He never gets rid of sloth and torpor.
Maybe it might be included under in the other. Which one would that be included under? Sloth and torpor.
Ignorance.
Yeah, but which one of the ten fetters? Ignorance? Could be, yeah.
Would an anagami have sloth and torpor?
Well, I'd hope not, but I don't know.
A bit
doubt,
no. Restlessness.
Yeah, I mean, I think most directly under ignorance, yeah, sloth and torpor is like,
I don't want to know. Restless people are up and about,
I don't want to know, I want to...
Thinking of projects and stuff.
But I don't think, I mean, you know, obviously an anagami is perfected in samadhi, I don't think they're going to have very kind of gross forms of sloth and torpor, but it might happen occasionally. Okay, let's finish by paying respects.
What does that mean?
The trainee.